Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Two takes on Cuba, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. President Obama preps for an historic trip to Havana. For Cubans, the visit is complicated.
They're watching the dismantling of the revolution.
But that's just one view.
Well, in many ways, the visit of the President of the United States to Havana marks the validation of the Cuban Revolution.
Plus, what would Shakespeare say about Europe's migrant crisis?
He says, imagine how you would feel if you were banished from your homeland. If you found yourself in a strange place, you know, you would then be the alien.
And Catholics in New Orleans prep for St. Joseph's Day with some timeless recipes.
On St. Joseph's Day, you don't cook food with meat, but we have all the meatless dishes the Italians ever cooked.
That's all ahead on The World. President Obama will make history on Sunday when he lands in Cuba, first U.S. president to travel there in 88 years. Obama has argued that normalizing relations with Cuba will lead to positive change on the island, the kind of change that just hasn't happened through decades of Cold War animosity. Right now, we're going to hear two different views on the president's upcoming trip to Havana. In a few minutes, a reality check on greater U.S.-Cuba business ties. First, Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive in Washington. Kornbluh's got a seat on the official White House press plane to Havana, and he's expecting Obama's visit to generate plenty of powerful visuals.
There'll be images of Cubans lining the street, applauding the President of the United States in great masses. I believe the president will appear on Cuban television. He will go to the ball game and watch a baseball exhibition competition between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Cuban National All-Star Team. And he will bring tremendous media attention to this new policy of engagement that he is pursuing.
I'm assuming President Obama is going to make an address of some sort. Where will he do it, and what are your expectations for that?
There was some talk of President Obama making a public address on the steps of the Cuban Congress. It's a congressional building that is actually an exact model of the U.S. Congress building, so although it's a foot higher. The Cubans are fond of reminding every visitor. And, of course, that would have great symbolic and visual use for his speech. The White House has not handed out his itinerary yet, so we don't know exactly where and when he's going to make his formal public presentation. But I'm sure that the White House has spent a great deal of time giving thought to the language that he's going to use, the moderate tone that he's going to adopt, the fine line between pushing the U.S. agenda on democracy and human rights and also showing respect for his hosts so that this normalization process can go forward.
Is Barack Obama expected to meet with Cuban dissidents?
He has tactfully arranged, I believe, a meeting with the leadership of the opposition to the Castro regime. That meeting will be held, I think, discreetly. I'm not sure whether it'll be at the U.S. residency or the U.S. embassy or where.
I'm struck by how it doesn't seem as if Cuban officials have done much that President Obama can point to as meeting him halfway. Human Rights Watch says Cuba remains one of Latin America's most politically repressive countries. Political prisoners remain behind bars. Journalists and activists can't move freely. Will Cubans be making any moves on this front during Obama's visit to loosen those restrictions?
The Cubans really aren't into quid pro quos. They don't make concessions. They don't yield to demands. They don't do horse trading. And I don't think we can expect to see Raul Castro meeting the demands of the United States on human rights in a very high-profile trip from the President of the United States. The president's strategy here is to first establish positive relations, remove the threat of U.S. aggression against Cuba, which I think will help the human rights situation over the long term. His strategy is to open the doors to commerce, which affects the daily life of many Cubans, help Cuban economy privatized, which will give much more control to Cubans, and expect that down the road that will have an impact on the evolution of the Cuban political system. Now, you know, the Cubans have several other big issues with the United States. One of them is that they want Guantanamo back. This is a part of their territory that was essentially taken by the United States at the turn of the 20th century, and they would like to see it return to Cuban sovereignty. And when the United States raises issues of human rights with the Cubans, of course, the Cubans raise issue of human rights of what's going on at the Guantanamo base. So there are actually, under this new umbrella of normal diplomatic relations, actual task forces that have been set up on both sides to discuss negotiations on the human rights issue, along with all the other issues of mutual interest between the two countries. They are at least talking about this issue.
Peter Kornbluh directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. He's the co-author with William Leogrand of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Carol.
U.S. entrepreneurs haven't had much luck in their efforts to get access to Cuban markets. John Kavalik is the president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council. John, you've kept a count, and it seems some 500 American businessmen and women have made the pilgrimage to Cuba in the past 14 months or so since President Obama announced his intention to normalize relations. What's come out of those visits?
Not a lot. Generally, the Cuban government has taken the position that if a Obama administration initiative creates revenue for it, then it is likely to be embraced. If that initiative costs money, then it is likely to be taken under advisement. So what we have had during the last 15 months are two small companies that have announced a desire to have an operational presence in Cuba, one manufacturing, one distribution. They received authorization from the U.S. government. They received partial authorization from the Cuban government. Now it's a matter to see if they actually come to fruition. But what we do have is a breathtakingly large number of aspirational thinkers who go down to Cuba, see 11.3 million potential customers, and believe that they have the answer. And then they're introduced to someone who knows who they need to speak with. And in the end, they come back disappointed.
So these latest announcements by the Obama administration, don't they make it a little bit easier for aspiring American business people to do business, allowing American dollars to be used in transactions? Non-immigrant Cubans can earn salaries in the U.S., U.S. banks allowing open accounts for Cubans. Won't that hasten this effort at all?
It potentially will. The challenge is that the Cuban government isn't looking at the same time frame as the Obama administration. The Cuban government has still said no or not said anything about most of the Obama administration changes. Now, yesterday, the changes that took place were dramatic because one of them, which was removing the restrictions upon Cuba's use of the U.S. dollar for international transactions. That's a very, very big deal. The question now will be how the Cuban government responds. Cuba is finding that its ability to forestall, to prevent making changes that, in essence, the U.S. government would like it to make, it's dwindling, and their options are dwindling. So,
but what's in their interest for not making the changes? I mean, if business would improve the amount of hard currency, if business would bring more to Cuba to then be able to do things with, what's behind it? Is it an entrenchment, the way things have always been, not wanting to lose control, not wanting to abandon a centralized economy? What's going on?
It's all of that. They're watching the dismantling of the revolution. Part of what President Obama's initiatives have helped to reestablish is the middle class in Cuba. And the Cuban Revolution was much about ridding Cuba of its middle class.
One thing Cuba does have, though, is an educated workforce. I mean, it's really poised to make not a seamless transition, but a transition to a pretty high-functioning country, given level of education and skills. Isn't there a way that that transfer could be made?
There is. However, the stumbling block to all of this is how we perceive what may be good for Cuba. You know, we will look at Cuba and say 11.3 million citizens. They have a high education. They have a high awareness of U.S. brands, a high preference for U.S. brands. You have about 18% of what is the Cuban population living in South Florida, Northern New Jersey, and Southern California. You have a lot of interest. U.S. companies were there. They want to be back. But you also have a Cuban government that looks at all of that and doesn't see a lot of friendly faces.
John Kavalik is the president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council. Thanks for speaking with us, John.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Picture this. An angry mob has gathered in the town square, and they're demanding that immigrants leave the country. A courageous man steps up to urge the mob to have more compassion. Sounds like something that could happen today, right? In Europe, or maybe even here. But what I just described is actually a scene written by William Shakespeare some 400 years ago. It's from a play called The Book of Sir Thomas More, and a copy of the script, handwritten by Shakespeare himself, is now viewable online for the first time. Anna Lobenberg is with the British Library.
This is a manuscript in the British Library which we've digitized for our new website, Discovering Literature Shakespeare. It's about Sir Thomas More, who was Henry VIII's Lord Chancellor and who was executed for treason for being opposed to the Reformation. It was a collaborative play, and Shakespeare was commissioned to write a particularly controversial scene in which Thomas More makes an impassioned speech to a group of rioters on the streets of London. And the rioters are calling for French immigrants to be banished from England. These are refugees who have fled from persecution on the continent.
These are the French Huguenots or French Protestants.
That's right, and Italian Lombards.
And so, of course, it has significance today. Is that why you're releasing it?
That's absolutely right. I think one of the most moving things about the scene that Shakespeare's written is that Moore asks the rioters to empathize with the refugees. He says, imagine how you would feel if you were banished from your homeland, if you found yourself in a strange place, you know, you would then be the alien. And he pleads with them to sort of confront what he calls their mountainous inhumanity. So I think, you know, this is particularly resonant at the moment with the international refugee crisis.
Did I read correctly that Ian McKellen, there's a recording of him reading this famous part of the play, the Thomas More speech?
That's right. There is a recording on YouTube, which I only found this morning, actually. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's very, very moving, particularly, as you say, in light of what's happening with the refugee crisis around the world.
Imagine that you see the wretched strangers, their babies at their backs with their poor luggage, plodding to the ports and coasts for transportation, and that you sit as kings in your desires. This is the stranger's case.
The play was originally written by a playwright called Anthony Munday in the 1590s, but at that time all play scripts had to go through the censor before players were allowed to perform them. And in this case, the censor said, no, this is too controversial, it's not going ahead. Thomas More was fighting against the monarch. There were fears that it might incite civil unrest.
Just my final question is, back when the French Huguenots and Lombards were going to England as a refuge, are we talking thousands of thousands, like today's refugee crisis?
I believe so, yes. I know that Shakespeare was writing at a time when London was being transformed by immigrants. And again, you know, resonating with today, people complained about foreigners taking their jobs. But these were Huguenots fleeing from religious persecution in their homeland.
Anna Lobenberg is project manager for the Discovering Literature website at the British Library. Thanks for speaking with us today, Anna.
Thank you so much.
A script actually written in Shakespeare's own hand, now online. It's pretty incredible. If you'd like to see it, head over to PRI.org. But be warned, the bard's handwriting definitely isn't easy to read. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We all know that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. He was famously looking for a shortcut to the riches of Asia. But it was Vasco da Gama who really revolutionized world trade in 1498. That's when da Gama became the first European to actually reach Asia by sea. Today, we're remembering the Portuguese explorer because of new research on a shipwreck from one of his expeditions. The World's one-man history desk, Chris Wolfe, has the details.
According to the International Journal of Nautical Archaeology, published just yesterday, it's almost certainly the Esmeralda, which is a Portuguese carrack, a three-masted ship, captained by Vasco da Gama's uncle, a chap called Vicente Sodré, on da Gama's second voyage. And the Esmeralda was lost way back in 1503. That's 513 years ago. I mean, Columbus was still alive.
So, of course, this was a later expedition of his from the famous 1498. Where was this ship found?
It was actually off the coast of Arabia, off the country now called Oman, on a group of islands called Al Halaniya. It's just right on the edge of the Indian Ocean, so it's not kind of where you might expect it to be.
So who found it?
It was actually one of these nautical archaeology companies, you know, treasure hunter people, the Blue Water Recoveries. They're one of the more reputable ones because they work with the local authorities and museums and archaeologists to preserve what they find. But the story is interesting. They're just intrigued by the legend of the loss of this ship and another one that was with it, the San Pedro. And they went through the archives for 6 months, figured out what islands they were on, went to the islands, and that's where the sailors came in. They said, okay, if we were sailors, we would anchor it there. And when this particular kind of storm comes in, the waves will be blowing here. So let's search over there. So they started snorkeling and within 20 minutes found their first cannonball. It was like, these guys are good.
Wow, that's incredible. I want to go back to the expedition for a minute. This particular expedition, what was Vasco da Gama after in this particular expedition?
Well, the Portuguese effort became focused on southern India. This is where they first landed. It's where they first started to collect pepper and other spices and silks and ceramics and stuff like that. And they would collect them in these trading posts, and then the ships would come each year and collect them and take them back to Europe. It was violent kind of hostile trade. It wasn't very easily, nicely conducted. And these trading posts were very vulnerable to attack. And da Gama had just left for Europe with the latest annual shipment. And he left his uncle, Vicente Sodré, in charge of the naval squadron to guard these little trading posts. But he decided he'd have much more fun and make a lot more money if he went off and basically lived the life of a pirate. So he took himself off to Arabia. And the trade winds at that time of year make ships traveling to the Red Sea and to the Persian Gulf travel along that route. So he was out for plunder, basically. And that's why he was off this coast at this particular time. But his greed cost him dearly in the end, because the locals said, don't park here in the middle of this particular kind of storm that we can see is coming. You want to be on the other side of the island. And so four of his ship's captains were so fed up with him, they kind of mutinied and went to the safe anchorage. And the greedy uncle stayed there and, well, sadly died along with all of his men in the shipwreck that followed.
What kind of things have been recovered from the shipwreck?
All kinds of things. The new article documents 2,800 artifacts that have been discovered so far. And it's amazing the kind of things they tell us, like the size of the ship. And this is really important because, like, no ship had been discovered yet from this early on in this stage of exploration. There's another one from the late 16th century, but the Portuguese ships were much bigger by then. This is kind of the size of the Mayflower. If you've ever seen the reconstructed Mayflower, can you imagine sailing 10,000 miles across the ocean in this tiny little wooden, you know, kind of floating coffin thing. And so you get to see the size of the ship. You get to see these artifacts.
Like what kind of artifacts? What are they?
The Portuguese did what's kind of called hostile trade by historians, meaning they would go and bully people into trading with them. So the preponderance of these artifacts are weapons, cannonballs of stone and metal, musket barrels and other kinds of weapons. But also the things that, you know, that you get from trade, like peppercorns and coins, including some very rare coins that were able to help them identify the ship. And then there's, I think, the most poignant things are the ordinary ones that illustrate the lives of the ordinary sailors, you know, buckles, pewter plates, cookware, ceramics for storage, knives, tool handles, and even personal possessions like beads and pendants and little things like fishing weights that they would have used to find food.
Where will these things end up? In a museum or back in Portugal?
Yes, they're going to end up in a museum and not in some private collection or sold and auctioned off, you know, and we're not sure yet if it's going to be in Oman or in Portugal. So we'll have to see.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome, Carol.
The cycling world is embroiled in yet another controversy. This time it involves current world champion Peter Sagan of Slovakia. No, he didn't dope, nor did he cheat by hiding a motor in his bicycle. What Sagan did was far more brazen for an elite cyclist. He showed up to a race with hairy legs, unshaven. I asked John Stevenson to comment on this shocking development. He's with the cycling website road.cc.
I think Peter Sagan just loves to be the center of attention. And to turn up at the beginning of the season with hairy legs just gets everyone's attention.
You know, I was completely joking when I expressed surprise, because why can't he have hairy legs? He's a guy. And actually, a woman can have hairy legs, too. What's the deal over hairy legs on cyclists?
there's a ton of excuses cyclists make for shaving their legs. It makes it easier to get a massage, wounds heal quicker, it's supposed to be more aerodynamic. But I've always thought that really at the root of it, it's just, it's a thing that cyclists do because cyclists do it. Though interestingly, Specialized, the bike manufacturer, did some wind tunnel research last year and found that there was enough drag off leg hair that if you were doing a race against the clock, a time trial, there was a significant advantage in having your legs shaved. So maybe it's not just a piece of being in the club, but there is a genuine competitive reason for doing it.
Come on, really? For hairy legs?
Yeah, well, aerodynamics is incredibly important to cyclists, particularly at, you know, the level of a professional like Sagan, because the air is what you're fighting when you're on a bike. It's the main thing that stops you going forward, which is why in the last few years we've seen all these increasingly aerodynamic bikes. We've seen deeper wheel rims that cut the air faster. And if you're talking about a time trial in the Tour de France, and these things are won sometimes by seconds, if you've got a 30-second advantage over a 25-mile time trial, that's really worth having, particularly if all it costs you is some foam and a razor.
Is the cycling culture offended by hairy legs because it's just something that cyclists don't do? Or are they just offended by hairy legs, period?
I think offend is a little bit strong. It's breaking the rules, but nobody takes the rules quite that seriously with this.
Is shaving your legs actually a rule for cyclists?
No, absolutely not. There's no written rule in any of the equipment rule books or like that that says you have to have your legs shaved. But it's a very strong unwritten guideline.
So is Peter Sagan going to bow to pressure and shave his legs, or is this a sort of permanent statement?
No, I believe he has. I believe he has actually turned up this week in the race he was taking part in and shaved his legs, bowed to peer pressure, not to be scruffy.
Do female cyclists shave their legs too?
Yes. Most women shave their legs. We could probably go on for hours about the semiotics and the social pressure of that. But serious cyclists shave their legs, whether they're male or female.
Do you shave your legs?
No, I've never been that serious. I like to ride a bike, and sometimes I like to ride a bike a long way for a long time. But the closest I've ever been personally to being a competitive cyclist was mountain biking many years ago. I was never any good. I certainly wasn't good enough to take myself seriously enough to shave my legs.
John Stevenson reports on cycling for the website road.cc. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This Saturday, Catholics in New Orleans get a second taste of Mardi Gras, thanks to a tradition imported from Sicily.
The Italian cabbage, and the Italian fish, the shrimp balls, and oh, baby, it'd be good.
The Feast of St. Joseph, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. On the surface, the war in Yemen doesn't seem to involve the United States. Two Yemeni factions are vying for control of the country. And one side is backed by Yemen's next-door neighbor, Saudi Arabia. But that's the connection right there. Saudi Arabia is a key U.S. ally, and we sell them weapons. Take the airstrikes yesterday on a town north of Yemen's capital, Sana'a. They were carried out by a Saudi-led military coalition. The bombs hit a local marketplace, reportedly killing 65 people, including women and children. The fighter jets and other weapons used in the operation were likely supplied by either the U.S. or the United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia's biggest arms suppliers. Earlier, I spoke to Senator Chris Murphy about this. The Connecticut Democrat is among the few politicians in Washington who are questioning the sale of American military hardware to Saudi Arabia. Senator Murphy, you've called the Saudi air war on Yemen irresponsible, and you've argued that Congress should stop supplying weapons to the Saudis. How come?
It's hard for me to figure out what the U.S. national security interests are inside the civil war in Yemen. What we know is that our support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign is killing a lot of civilians, is leading to a humanitarian disaster. And for U.S. purposes, probably more importantly, there is significant evidence that the growing chaos inside Yemen has provided ample opportunity for both ISIS and al-Qaeda to expand their operations inside Yemen. Now, I understand the Saudis are and have been our allies for a long time. I'm not suggesting that we walk away from that alliance, but that alliance doesn't mean that we have to back the Saudis' play in every instance where they make requests in the Middle East.
Have you gotten much of a response from fellow politicians in Washington?
Right now, I'm the loudest voice here. There are a handful of members of the House who have raised similar objections, and I've been talking to my colleagues both on the Republican and Democratic side as well. This is a hard habit to break. You know, we have been taught over the decades that the Saudis are our irresolute partner, and I'm not seeking to break that alliance. I'm just seeking to make it somewhat more conditional. And so I'm going to be seeking to, you know, pursue at least some conditions upon our military support for the campaign in Yemen.
What kind of conditions?
They stop using cluster bombs, that they commit to not purposefully targeting civilians, so that they allow for humanitarian relief to reach displaced populations, that they make a commitment not to in any way directly coordinate with Sunni extremist groups. These are the kind of conditions that we have so far been unwilling to put to the Saudis. I think it's time we do it.
You represent the people of Connecticut, and that includes two big arms makers who do business with Saudi Arabia, Pratt & Whitney, which makes and maintains jet engines, and Sikorsky, which produces the Black Hawk helicopter. How do you explain your position to them?
So, you know, ultimately, I'm tasked with creating jobs in Connecticut, but first and foremost, I'm tasked with keeping America safe from attack and keeping my state safe from attack. And so the most sacred obligation you have right now as a member of Congress is to prevent another 9/11 attack from happening. And so to me, the way in which we have sold arms to the Saudis without requiring them to be a true, lasting daily partner in the fight against extremism really puts our country's national security in jeopardy. And so, yeah, sometimes you have to make trade-offs between, you know, economic security and physical security for the nation. But the latter has to triumph when there's a conflict. And again, I'm not talking about stopping these arms sales. I'm just talking about raising the stakes and forcing the Saudis to step up to the plate and be a better partner as a condition of moving these sales forward.
Yemenis are about to mark the first anniversary of this war that's been going on, that's taken the lives of more than 3,000 civilians. What do you say to Yemenis who say the U.S. is actually ignoring them?
I think it's hard to read the U.S. Support for the Saudis as being helpful to Yemenis. We have, frankly, expanded and helped to grow the conflict. So if I'm listening to Yemenis on the ground, I think one of their first requests is for this relatively indiscriminate bombing campaign by the coalition to stop. And right now, the U.S. is facilitating that bombing campaign, leading to the destruction of cities, the deaths of civilians, and a growing humanitarian catastrophe inside Yemen. I worry that this is just another example of the United States feeling like we can change the political realities on the ground between Sunni and Shia with U.S. bombs and U.S. refueling planes. Ultimately, this has to be a reconciliation between the parties in the Middle East, whether it be the Iranians and the Saudis or the Shia and the Sunni, and more U.S. weapons thrown into the middle of that fight just prolongs the agony, and I don't necessarily think gets us anywhere closer to a conclusion.
Chris Murphy is a Democratic senator from Connecticut. Thanks so much, Senator Murphy.
Thanks for having me.
We also reached out to the U.S. State Department to discuss America's role in Yemen. They've responded, and we hope to hear from a State Department spokesperson next week here on The World. Now, our next story is about something that journalists often turn to when officials don't respond to a request for information, the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. It turns 50 this year. Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative news organization. It's been filing FOIA requests for over a decade. Justin, you wrote recently that FOIA has been a disaster under President Obama's watch. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, when President Obama came into office, actually on his first full day in office in 2009, he gave a speech about open government and the Freedom of Information Act in particular. He issued an executive order saying that there was going to be a presumption of openness and that he promised to run the most transparent administration in history. That was his phrase. You know, now we're nearing the end of the Obama administration, and all of the data and all of the anecdotal evidence from reporters is that FOIA and access to documents under Obama has been a complete disaster.
Tell us how FOIA actually works.
Sure. It's actually really simple, and you don't have to be a reporter. Anyone can do it. You don't even have to be a citizen. You just write a letter, or most agencies now allow you to just write an email, and it doesn't even actually have to have any particularly formal language. And you have to give a specific description of records that you're looking for. The law says that the agency then has 20 business days to come up with a response, but in practice, you almost never get a substantive response within 20 business days. It often takes many months.
Is there evidence that FOIA requests were processed in a more prompt fashion during the George W. Bush administration and previous administrations?
There has never been sort of a golden age where all of this was working smoothly. And a lot of people I've spoken to, FOIA lawyers, say that, you know, this law, which was actually passed 50 years ago this year under LBJ, has always been sort of under-resourced. That said, there is data showing that across the federal government, backlogs are growing significantly. Average processing times of requests are growing significantly under Obama.
You write about a Mexican journalist's request for El Chapo's arrest records. So what was the government response?
Right. This was a request to the DEA a couple of years ago after the first capture of El Chapo, asking about what was the DEA's role working with the Mexican government in that capture of El Chapo. The journalist got back a letter from the government saying that it was going to be $1.4 million in fees to process this request. Now, the law does allow the government to charge, but there is supposed to be a public interest waiver you can put in your request. I mean, another example, a colleague of mine, Michael Gray Bell, requested some records from the Transportation Security Administration, and it took 7.5 years to get them.
Give us some examples of how ProPublica has used FOIA in doing its reporting.
A few years ago, I was able to get records from the Defense Department about American arms sales to Bahrain, and this was during the Arab Spring protests there. They were then sort of violently put down by the government, which is an ally of the United States. And I was able to get some documents after an extended wait, but I did get them.
What made you decide to write about this issue now?
What actually precipitated my piece was an incredibly frustrating experience I had asking for documents from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. There is also a bill going through Congress right now that would codify the presumption of openness that President Obama talked about. So we're hopeful that a strong version of that passes and is signed by the president. I should also note it was reported this month by the Freedom of the Press Foundation that the Obama administration, despite all of its rhetoric about transparency, had actually strongly lobbied against an earlier version of this FOIA reform bill, sort of quietly and behind the scenes, which, again, is completely at odds with President Obama's rhetoric about transparency. So the administration has really been a disaster on FOIA.
Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica. You can find his article on the state of the FOIA system on ProPublica and at PRI.org. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
We're coming up on a big Saints Day. Nope, not the one where people drink green beer and sing maudlin tunes. I'm talking about the Feast of St. Joseph on Saturday. It's celebrated by Catholics around the world, but it gets some special love in New Orleans. Nina Feldman has that story.
It's 11 a.m. on a Wednesday, and David Rowe is directing a team of bakers in his kitchen.
Stack them, and we'll just put it back in the fridge.
Yeah.
David has a small crew of volunteers baking hundreds of Italian cookies and cakes at his house. All of them will go on the St. Joseph's altar at St. Augustine Church. Here's one of his helpers, Joe, rolling out some dough.
I'm making the cucciadattis here. They were probably the predecessors to the Fig Newton. Started by little Sicilian ladies.
These cookies are essential for a St. Joseph's altar, but they're just the beginning. The altars get covered in breads shaped like fish, cakes shaped like lambs, and these incredibly ornate fig cakes, also called cucciadatti. Here's how this whole thing got started.
The legend is that back in the Middle Ages, maybe it was 12th century, maybe earlier, there was a famine in Sicily.
That's Sandra Scalise Juno. She's Sicilian, also a baker, and a local expert on the tradition.
Sicily had been the breadbasket for Rome, so you can imagine these people were starving.
During the famine, the only thing that would grow was the fava bean, usually fed to animals. The Sicilians prayed to their patron saint, Joseph, and the fava bean kept them fed through the drought. When the rains finally came, the Sicilians attributed their good fortune to St. Joseph and pledged to thank him with an elaborate feast, pretty much forever. And the fava bean...
The fava bean became the symbol of their hope and is known in New Orleans as the lucky bean.
Sicilians arrived in large numbers to New Orleans around the turn of the 20th century. Many of them built altars in their homes and storefronts on St. Joseph's Day. They'd go from house to house, each marked with a palm frond out front to indicate who had an altar inside. While the tradition has Sicilian origins, its observers don't always. St. Augustine Church is the oldest Black Catholic parish in the country. When David heard the church needed help baking for its altar, he decided to lend a hand. After all, he says, back in the day, the parishioners at St. Augustine helped his ancestors.
The Sicilians were considered, even by other Italians, to be the lowest of the low. Sicilians were not allowed to worship in the major Catholic churches. The first church that took them in, that allowed them to come in, was St. Augustine's church in the Treme.
Beverly Curry is in charge of the St. Joseph's altar at St. Augustine and grew up in the Treme around the corner from the church. She tries to honor the Sicilian origins of the holiday, even though it's not her heritage.
On St. Joseph Day, you don't cook food with meat, but we have all the meatless dishes that the Italians ever cooked. And it'd be so good. Lord, I can't eat that, but it's good. Whew. The Italian cabbage and the Italian fish and the shrimp balls and, oh, baby, it'd be good.
Not everyone is such a purist, though. For some, St. Joseph's Day has taken on a totally new meaning. Charisse Harrison Nelson grew up in a family of Mardi Gras Indians. If you've never seen them, the Mardi Gras Indians are groups of African Americans that dress as Native Americans. Each year, the Indians spend countless hours sewing elaborate suits of beads and feathers by hand. On Carnival Day, they parade through the streets in their suits and meet each other in a sort of ritualized theatrical battle.
They dance, chant. You brag on yourself, I'm that pretty, pretty spy boy, pretty in the front, pretty in the back. You know, I got a big cheek, blah, 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 blah.
Traditionally, you hear about the Indians parading and singing on Mardi Gras Day.
The only other time you really see that is on St. Joseph's Night.
Nobody knows exactly why the Mardi Gras Indians chose St. Joseph's Night. For Sicilians, St. Joseph's has always been a day off from the austerity of Lent. You could let loose, celebrate, even get married. So the theory goes that the Mardi Gras Indians picked up on their Sicilian neighbors' tradition and took their suits out for one last spin. What we do know is that even today, St. Joseph's is a holiday that transcends cultural lines here.
So what we're going to do is prepare our dough.
Sandra Juno spent a recent Saturday at Xavier University in New Orleans, which is historically Black and Catholic.
But yeah, that's what happens. It starts binding to itself.
Clumping.
It also expands.
She's teaching students here how to make the cucidati, those traditional Sicilian fig cakes.
In every culture, the making of dough, the baking of bread, is the most communal thing that you can do, every culture. So for us to be baking bread together, to be baking these beautiful cakes together, I think is about the most loving thing that we can do together.
The cucidati will go on Xavier's altar, which is also topped with a West African kente cloth. For The World, Nina Feldman, New Orleans.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. John Kasich may have won Ohio yesterday, but the Republican presidential nomination looks like it's Donald Trump's to lose at this point. And today, the GOP frontrunner gave us an idea of what his general campaign strategy might be, assuming he's running one-on-one against Hillary Clinton. It's an ad featuring Russian President Vladimir Putin performing martial arts while Hillary Clinton barks like a dog. It ends with Putin laughing and the words, "We don't need to be a punchline." Even by this campaign season's standards, the ad seems way below the line. But it does highlight something else, the apparent admiration that continues to build between candidate Trump and the Russian leader. We wanted to know more about how this looks from the Russian side. So we asked Anna Nemtsova. She writes for the Daily Beast from her base in Moscow. And she says Putin sees Trump as a good alternative to President Obama.
the Kremlin politicians, including Putin, have been blaming Obama for all sorts of sins, starting from the war in Ukraine and unleashing the war in Syria, as they say. And that was the beginning. So people build this bridge quickly. Our problems, our current problems with low salaries, no jobs, this is all Obama's fault. Donald Trump says Russia hates us because of Obama. Obama did everything wrong, so Russia hates us. And I will make friends with Putin.
It seems like Russian authorities blame Hillary Clinton for many of the problems around the globe, including the refugee crisis. How does that work?
The mainstream media right now, the main line is that look at Europe. Look at what is happening to Europe. Europe is about to fall apart. And that is also the fault of the United States. And Hillary Clinton is being blamed currently for the refugee crisis. It seems that in Russia, the propaganda have no doubt that sooner or later, European Union is going to fall apart.
And so they kind of blame her because she was Secretary of State when some of the decisions were made or not made about Syria. So she's an easy target to blame for everything that's going on now.
Exactly. To many in post-Soviet Union, State Department symbolizes anti-Russian America. And Hillary Clinton is seen, largely seen, as somebody who hates Russia. So Donald Trump and Putin sound like somebody who say truth, the truth that they want to hear.
Is it also something about Trump's personality that appeals to Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir Putin believes that Trump is an absolute leader of the election campaign at the moment, and that's what Putin says.
From a Russian perspective, does Donald Trump appear to be supportive of issues that Putin cares about?
Well, Donald Trump said he would make friends with Putin, that he's okay with Putin, and he's seen as a hope by anti-American politicians, somebody who might go along the lines of Putin's policies.
Anna Nemtsova is a writer for The Daily Beast. She's based in Moscow. Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you.
Back now to where we started today's show, with Cuba. Most Sunday nights, you can find Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra on stage at Birdland in New York. That's where we found them last Sunday. Before the show, Arturo O'Farrell took a few moments to talk about Cuba. It's an emotional topic for him. His dad was Chico O'Farrell, a famous Cuban jazz composer and conductor who was born in Havana. He left before Fidel Castro's revolution, but was never able to return. Arturo says his dad never got over it.
He's one of those people that felt heartbroken that he was never able to return because of political nonsense. And so when he died, I was very, very sad, because that's the only thing that really he communicated to me. It was just incredible heartbrokenness.
Chico O'Farrell died in 2001, and Arturo has carried on his dad's legacy, both on the jazz scene and as a Cuban-American. The two converge on Arturo's latest album, Cuba. The conversation continues. It was recorded in Havana on the day President Obama announced the U.S. would begin to normalize relations with Cuba.
We didn't know. And it caught us by surprise when the announcement came that he was going to open relationships a year ago. We had no idea.
Arturo says he and his band were apprehensive when they heard the news.
Cubans are very reserved and conservative, and the overwhelming response that I had then and that I have now is, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I love that, because that's, I think, so typically Cuban. After having suffered an economic embargo, an economic blockade for so many years, and having all kinds of promises made for that moment to arrive, was really quite scary for them.
But now he says he's thrilled Obama is about to make the first presidential visit to Cuba in 88 years.
For this to happen, for this to take place next week, is beyond what I ever thought I'd see in my time.
It's not clear what all these diplomatic changes will mean for Cuba-U.S. relations, but speaking as a musician, Arturo says it will be great for musical exchanges.
Once a U.S. passport can be presented at an airline ticket counter and you just get on a plane, that'll be a miraculous moment. Once a Cuban passport can be presented at an airline ticket counter and the person can just go back and forth, it's just going to be amazingly easy to break down these walls and to see musicians of both sides experience each other.
Thank you. Arturo plans to go back to Cuba very soon. He wants to pay tribute to his dad and do a concert of Chico's music. He'll also be bringing his father's cremated remains with him to bury in the National Cemetery. As for how he thinks his dad would have reacted to the changes taking place now,
I think my father would weep with joy. I think my father would be overcome with emotion. I think he'd be beyond happy. I think he'd be tremendously, tremendously touched deep inside his soul.
Before we go, here's another track from the new CD by Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you tomorrow.
Que es un encanto, el buen sabor que tienen estos bombones, a la mente y a la la la.
PRI, Public Radio International.